Welcome, everybody. We're so pleased to see such a large crowd today. My name is Karen Bond. I'm on the board of Chicago Media Action. And this morning, as I was getting dressed, the television was on and a commercial for one of my truly favorite musicals. It's coming back to Chicago, and I'm going to see it again for about the 10th time, I'm sure. Evita. And the quotation over the pictures was, "Saint or sinner, she simply seduced a nation." And when I thought about the movie that we were coming to see, and thought about just the feeling 4 years ago when we woke up and found out what had happened, well, actually it was 4 years and then a month and a week, and I don't remember how long it took. I just thought about that, and Evita had a lot of faults, but she just kind of worked the crowd. So I was just interested in that comparison between her and what we're going to do here today. A couple of announcement items. First of all, the sign-in sheets are now here in the lobby. Some of you, they weren't here when you got here. Please sign in, and please, if you have any access to email, either through your home or your business, please leave us an email address. That's how you'll get the notices for these events. And also, anybody who doesn't have one of these programs, if you raise your hand, Mitchell will make sure you have one. If I can direct your attention to the back of the program, first it talks about membership, which is free in Chicago, if you want to join Chicago Media Action. It is not a club, it's a movement. We do have expenses. Yes, there's a membership fee of $12 if you choose to pay that. If you choose to pay zero, that's your membership fee. Something just happened. Oh, okay. Again, the back of the program. First United Methodist Church. This is an amazing, amazing institution. If you could give them a hand, I'd so appreciate it. I just cannot believe how they are able to take into account the needs of their membership, but also open their doors and allow for events like this. They've been helpful throughout the process. They always are. And as I've said before, they're really living their faith within the community of Chicago and in all communities of Chicago, and that is to be commended. At the bottom of your program on the back, you'll see the information for contacting Chicago Media Action. Our toll-free number is 866-260-7198. That's 866-260-7198. We have a website at www.chicagomediaaction.org. Please check out the website. There's some very interesting things there, like the WTTW study that we did on Channel 11, which proves quantitatively that our public television station is not serving the public of Chicago, and we plan to do something about that. Is Ronald Bryant here? Where are you? Okay. Can you come up front for a second for me, please, Ronald? Ronald is one of our CMA members, and the last time we were here, the most amazing thing he said to me out in the lobby, he said, "I brought my kids because I wanted them to realize that, you know, Martin Luther King was not all about only a dream." And I talked to him not too long ago, and he said, "There may be lots of PhDs and doctorates and what have you, but people are not taking responsibility, personal responsibility for learning about the issues and making informed decisions in this society. So I got to thinking, and he doesn't know that I'm going to ask this of him. We have an outstanding panel this afternoon, and I'd like to ask Ronald to join the panel. Would you? Okay. We're about empowering the working class to get a sense of their own power so that they can take control of their media. And you're a perfect representation of that. Can you stay right there? And then when we have our panel come up, you can come up here. Thank you so much, Ronald. I appreciate that. Okay, we do have three fantastic speakers today. We have our moderator, Cliff Kelly. He's been active in the Chicago political arena for over 30 years. And you can stay down. I'm going to bring you guys up in just a few, okay? But that's Cliff right there. he's an attorney, a political commentator, and he has two programs on Chicago radio. If you look at the front of your program, you'll see that he is on Monday through Friday at 1450 a.m., and he's on Sunday mornings at 102.7 FM from 6 to 8. Please, please make sure that you follow his program and keep informed. Another speaker that we have today is Salim Muwakkil. Oh, there you are. Salim is a senior editor of In These Times magazine, an op-ed columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and an Open Society Institute Criminal Justice Initiative fellow. Two of the things that I always say about Cliff and Salim is that they are, yes, they're journalists and they're pundits, but they're more qualified than most because they're everywhere. Whenever something's happening, you'll see one or both of them there, and you have the accessibility. You can buttonhole them and tell them what you're thinking, and they can incorporate that into their thinking process. And that is invaluable in the kind for the kind of media that we're trying to create in this city. Okay. Now I'd like to introduce John Nichols. John Nichols is the author of Dick, The Man Who Is President. And excuse the typo, there is no is on this program, but Dick, The Man Who Is President. He is a DC correspondent for The Nation magazine and a co-founder of the national media reform group, Free Press. And I'll tell you that John and then Salim and then Cliff will take the podium and then Cliff will take over the duties of you speaking at the mic. So, but as far as John is concerned, I had talked to him at length about some of the issues that we're talking about tonight, and related but not totally related, we got into a discussion about the black voter. And I asked him specifically to talk about his analysis of the black voter in America, which I think is critically important for a lot of people, especially white activists, to understand and to get perspective and context. So without further ado, John Nichols.
I love when you have the phone right up front here. You can call right up to the big guy. Thank you, Karen Bond. And my brother Mitchell right back there, and all the people from Chicago Media Action. What a fantastic group. I am honored to be a part of a panel organized by this group, and also tremendously honored to be on a panel. I think there's a plane coming in. No. Tremendously honored to be on a panel with two journalists who I respect immensely. I was on Cliff's show this morning, and I got to tell you, I've been interviewed since the new book on Dick Cheney came out. I've been interviewed about 150 times. And I want to tell you, Cliff, that was by far the most thoughtful, nuanced interview I had the whole 150 times. You beat CNN by a mile, brother. And Salim, I don't have to introduce Salim to you folks, but I do have to tell you that in this nation, you know, you guys are Chicagoans, and Salim's like me. I live in Madison, Wisconsin, and I like to stay by the people I grew up with and the people I know. But Salim likes to stay in Chicago because this is where he's from. Salim could go to New York tomorrow. He could go to Washington tomorrow. He is not a great Chicago journalist. He is a great American journalist, and you are tremendously lucky to have him. Now, Karen asked me to talk for a moment about something that was supposedly off topic, and that is race. But of course, you know, race is never off topic, is it? Not in America. We haven't quite sorted things out well enough for that. And I am delighted to do it because, you know, in the next week to 10 days, you are about to hear the biggest lie in American politics repeated once more. There are so many lies in American politics, it is almost impossible to pick a winner. But we can pick it. We know what it is. The biggest lie in American politics, which will be repeated 1,000 times with subtle variations, and in the polite language of CNN and MSNBC and Fox, is that the black voter is stupid, that the black voter is ignorant, that the black voter will vote Democrat, you know, just because that's what they do. You know, they get up in the morning, they put their clothes on, they vote Democrat. They never think. That you will hear that 1,000 times. And you will hear that lie used to disenfranchise African American voters again and again and again in the next 10 days. They will say, well, there's been a massive increase in registration in black neighborhoods. Something must be wrong. Why would black people be registering to vote in this election? Why would they care so much? And you will see the monitors. In my state of Wisconsin, they wear green coats. They call it election protection. But you know, it's an interesting thing. You're down on the north side of Milwaukee, right, which is overwhelmingly African-American neighborhood. And suddenly you see these white college students with green election protection jackets on. And they're going up to African-American voters and saying, do you live in this district? Did you register here? It is intimidation, it is structural, it is intentional, and the point is to disenfranchise African American voters, and it is rooted in the media's acceptance of the lie that African American voters don't think about what they do. But I want to just remind you of something. Karen and I had a long conversation about this, which was just absolutely wonderful. And she said, and I'm going to talk out of school for a second, tell you, she said, but, you know, I've got some white liberal allies, good people. They really do, they mean well, but every once in a while they'll say to me, you know, black voters don't quite get it. They're not quite thinking through all the subtleties of all this stuff. I says, well, I'll tell you, I have covered politics since 1972 when I was 11 years old. I rode my bicycle down to the local weekly newspaper, and I said, I want to be a reporter. And they tell you how bad the town was, how small the town was. They said, okay. Guy gave me $5 a story. My first interview of a presidential candidate in 1972 was with Hubert Humphrey. It was the bottom of his career, but the top of mine. And I've covered politics every election since then. And I've learned only one thing. The most sophisticated voters in America are African American voters. Right. African American voters see through the lie that politics doesn't matter. They see through the lie that says, oh, they're all the same. Because when you have been denied the franchise for 300 years through the crime, the original sin of slavery, and then when you have been denied it for another 100 years through the soft sin of segregation, you begin to understand that it matters. A little difference can make all the difference. And African-American voters get that very well. In Massachusetts in 1990, there was an election for governor. Democrats nominated a guy named Silber, S-I-L-B-E-R. He was a college professor, big intellectual. His big intellect had led him to believe that black people got too many breaks in society, that they were, you know, they just, you know, we need to get rid of affirmative action. We needed to get rid of, maybe make a lot of changes. He was a Democrat who didn't really like black people very much. And you know what the black community in Boston did? They didn't just knee-jerk vote Democrat. They looked over at the Republican, Bill Weld, who was a moderate to liberal Republican, who was very good on race issues, very good on civil rights issues. And they turned on a dime and voted Republican because they figured it out. They didn't have to be told. They didn't have to be led. Black voters are the most sophisticated voters in this country. They see through the lies. 1983, Chicago, Illinois. Right? You had a political machine here had been marching people up and down to the polls for decades, right? Harold Washington comes along. Says it. Did the black voters of Chicago say, oh, no, no, Daley's been good to us. We're going to stick to the Daley's, right? No. They came out in numbers historic, and they didn't just elect a black mayor. They elected my mayor. They elected Harold Washington, the mayor who was the most progressive leader in this country during that period. Black voters are sophisticated. Black voters are smart. Black voters matter in our politics so much. So in the next 10 days, when you see this lie coming forward, and you're going to hear it, I want you to get really mad. Not a little mad. I want you to get really mad. And if you hear a commentator on a radio station saying, oh, there's the black vote again, right? Or if you hear Republicans saying, you know, there's all these very troubling high registration patterns in our African-American neighborhoods. We think something's wrong as if they're... I want you to call them on it. I want you to get angry. I want you... This is the time for the picket line. This is the time for the angry call. This is the time for the letter. Do not let them spread this lie through another election. Do not let it happen. Now, that said, for my sister Karen, who I adore so much,
thank you.
I appreciate it. There's so much more to say. We could go on for hours. But I want to talk a little bit about media and then bring up our other good friends here. You know, I'm delighted to be here in Chicago because it's in Chicago that about a year and a half ago, one of the strangest things I ever saw in media occurred. And I want to recount it because I think it sums up everything that is amiss in our media. I live in Madison, Wisconsin. I get to travel all over the country, all over the world. It's a wonderful honor. But I'm a native Wisconsinite, seven generations. And so I'm home on a Friday night in Wisconsin. We were experiencing a Friday night with Wisconsinites due in March, which is, we had some pizza and we were watching TV. And the war in Iraq had just started. So we turned on America's news network, CNN. And we watched Aaron Brown. Everybody here know who Aaron Brown is?
Ooh.
No, Aaron's not. He isn't even that bad a guy. He's typical is the problem. But Aaron Brown is, he's one of the hosts of one of the CNN news shows. And he's a very, very serious, very thoughtful man. Whenever he's being serious, he lets you know by taking his glasses off and going like that. And he's a very thoughtful fellow. So Aaron Brown is very concerned. We turn the TV, he's very, very concerned. And he looks out into the TV camera and he says, we're about to show you something that's going to trouble you very much. Some people are going to really object to this. But we feel as a news network, we have to show it. But we want to warn you up front. It's very, very, it's going to be something some people are really going to be bothered by, really upset by. It's like all this warning. I thought, oh my God, what are we going to see? And I can't make this up. I wish I could. They went to a live helicopter shot of a peaceful anti-war demonstration in downtown Chicago. 7,000 people marching through downtown Chicago on a Friday night. I'll bet you some of you were in that crowd. And they showed this, and Aaron Brown had warned me about this. I thought this was going to be the most scary thing I'd ever seen. And then he comes back. And a couple minutes later, he says, oh, and it's in his earphone. He says, Oh, we've got some live shots from Baghdad. Let's go to that. And they flip over, and they've got bombs dropping on Baghdad. Now, we know that more than 80% of the bombs miss their target, right? When a bomb misses its target, unless you really are a genocidal maniac, what do you hit?
Women and children.
That's right. You hit innocent people when a bomb misses its target. So we're watching these bombs fall in Baghdad. Now, I hadn't been warned that I was going to see something offensive or bothersome when the bombs fell. I was warned that I would see something offensive and bothersome when peaceful anti-war demonstrators marched through the streets of Chicago. And I thought to myself, you know, if the alien came down this night, you know, and I assume that the alien from outer space would land in Wisconsin. If the alien came down this night and came over, you know, we'd greet the alien and say, well, how does this place work? And I'd say, well, come on over to the house. We'll get some beer, we'll get some pizza, we'll watch some television. That's pretty much what we do. And the alien would sit there with us and watch Aaron Brown warn us about anti-war demonstrations. Then he'd watch us casually go in and watch bombing of civilians, bombing of the innocents, bombing of women and children. And that alien would hightail it back to his saucer and go flying off into outer space. And he'd get back to his planet and they'd say, what's it like down there on Earth? What's it like down there in America? And he'd say, it's a very, very strange country. It's a place where you have to be warned and fearful of those who say, thou shalt not kill, but where they have no qualms at all about those who do kill. Our media makes us into something we should never want to be. Our media, with its lies and with its fundamental inaccuracies, makes Americans, all of us, into people who fear the peacemaker and love the warrior. Now, I'm not going to talk for a long time because we've got a wonderful panel here, but I do want to recount just a couple of quick moments. I was recently asked to go to Greece and to be the keynote speaker at the International Federation of Journalists Annual Congress. It's the largest group of journalists in the world, more than 500,000 members from every developed and developing country on the planet. They asked me to come for one reason. They said, you're an American media critic. Can you come here and explain to us how the American media alone in the world blew the story of the Iraq War? I said, how did it go so wrong? How did they allow this to happen? And so I had to think about it a little bit, because you know, when you're in the frying pan, you sometimes forget that you're burning. And so I had to stop and say, well, how did it go so bad? And the answer came pretty clearly. In this country, we have had 20 years of radical restructuring and shifts in regulation that has created a media, a broadcast media in particular, that is less accountable than at any time in the history of this republic. Civic and democratic values have been replaced with commercial and entertainment values. We have a media today that is more interested in Scott Peterson and that trial out in California, which I hate to tell you doesn't mean a thing to any of you, than it is in whether you have Social Security. It is more interested in, you know, what did Michael Jackson do last night than it is in whether we have a trade policy that gives us jobs or that takes our jobs away. We know more about Tonya Harding and all those figure skaters that get into fights than we do about the fundamental structures of our government. We have a media that simply does not serve democracy. And I will tell you something, as Hijacking Catastrophe illustrates, American media has been restructured to serve as the most efficient conduit of lies in history. I don't have to tell the people in this room that American media is antithetical to democracy. In 2000, we had a presidential election in the United States. And that election was close. Al Gore only won it by 600,000 votes. But because we have an electoral college set up in slavery days with the purpose of assuring that the northern states didn't get enough power to eliminate slavery, let's be sure, nobody forget about why we have an electoral college. And because we have an electoral college, the election wasn't settled when the people elected Al Gore. We had to go down to Florida And if we had a functional media in this country, the media would have said, as soon as they got down to Florida on the morning of November 8th, Mr. Gore, Mr. Bush, Mr. James Baker, former Secretary of State, Mr. Warren Christopher, former Secretary of State, please shut up. Please shut up. Because the campaign is over. Now the job is to count the votes. It's a fundamental responsibility. We want to know how Florida's vote turned out. So do not come here and tell us we got to count this four counties, or we got to count that four counties, or we got to not count these votes or do count those votes. Just shut up. Get out of our way and let us count the votes. That's what the media should have demanded. Instead, we got fair and balanced coverage of Florida. And fair and balanced coverage was James Baker, an old white guy, arguing with Warren Christopher, an old white guy, about whether we would count the votes of Haitian immigrants, and whether we would count the votes of Latinos, and whether we would count the votes of elderly Jewish garment workers and Holocaust survivors who, because of a bad ballot design, had ended up voting for the most notorious anti-Semite in America. That's the bottom line. We had a media that didn't cut through the lies and force us toward the truth. We had the wrong president because we had the wrong media. And I don't always agree with John Kerry, but he's right about one thing. We are in the wrong war at the wrong time in the wrong place.
Yeah.
And we are there because we have the wrong media. That our media in the run-up to the war in Iraq did such a horrible job of covering it that nobody even points out the absurdity of Aaron Brown calling peace protesters dangerous and scary, calling bombs falling on civilians something that's okay. We have a media that just does not do the job. And the worst lie of all that our media does, and I'll close off with this notion, the worst lies of all that they tell us are that this is the media you want. They said, you chose it, right? You chose this media because you tune in, so that must be. But you know, here's the interesting thing about that lie. What they never tell you, we see in polling, if Americans had a choice, how many of you would like to see more commercials on TV? Just throw your hands up. I want to see everybody in the room says that. More commercials, right? Well, polling shows something like 95% of Americans would like to see less commercials. If it was our choice, wouldn't we see less commercials?
Yes.
Of course, that's the truth. Bottom line is, we don't get the media we chose. We get the media that they give us. And they tell us a whole bunch of lies. They tell us it's so hard to hold a president accountable. It's hard to ask tough questions of the president of the United States. They had a press conference right before the war started. Right before the war started. President of the United States standing up there, not a single reporter asked a tough question. The reporters themselves acknowledged they didn't challenge him. Because, he's the president. We're going to war. There was this poor little Irish journalist. I'm Irish by background. There was this poor little Irish journalist. She works for the little Irish TV network. And she got an interview with Bush before he went to Ireland. This is just a few months ago. And they made her submit her questions. That's not journalism. That's a bad thing. But they made her submit her questions. She did. She says, look, I'm from Ireland. We only got 4 million people. How many chances do we get to interview the President of the United States? So she did. She came in. She did her interview with her. Her name's Carol Coleman. She asked him a question. Bush didn't answer it. And she said, Mr. President, you didn't answer my question. I wonder if I could just repose it for you so I could get an answer from you. And he said to her, we don't do that like that in America. He said, you don't tell me that I have to answer your question. I decide how I'm going to answer the question. And so she went, he didn't answer several other questions. And she kept saying, Mr. President, I wonder if you could just get to the point of the question that I asked. And he's going off on these tangents. And he started yelling at her. He started saying, no, man, I don't know what you're thinking. We don't do that this way in America. And he was right. Well, the president wasn't lying. He was absolutely right. We don't do it this way in America. Journalists from every other country in the world challenge their leaders, but American journalists don't. Well, that's wrong. That's a lie. The second lie they tell us it's really hard to cover the world. It's very expensive. It's very difficult, very challenging to cover the world. Well, you know what? It isn't that hard. I was in Greece to do this speech a while back. They had 23 daily newspapers in Athens. Most of them had correspondents in Iraq. They had all sorts of perspectives. They had a communist perspective on Iraq. They had a right-wing perspective on Iraq. They had a liberal, a conservative, all these different people. They get all this information out of there. It's not hard to do to cover the world. You know how easy it is to cover the world? George W. Bush, he's still trying to find Osama bin Laden. Right? Can't find Osama bin Laden. Very difficult. Except, you know, if you'd only read the Telegraph newspaper from London, 2 weeks after September 11th, the Telegraph, very conservative, mainstream daily newspaper, had an article about Osama bin Laden's going away party in Afghanistan. They had a reporter there who covered Osama bin Laden leaving town. Now, I will tell you what happens when you have a media that says it's hard to cover the world. You don't know about the world. And when you don't know about the world, then they can lie you into a war. They can hijack catastrophe. They tell you that bigness, you know, we got to get a bigger media so we can do a better job, right? You know, we got to, if we have bigger media, we have more money, we can do more reporting around the world. You want to know something? You know, remember Trent Lott? Everybody knows Trent Lott. He used to be the big guy in the Senate. Got in a little trouble when he explained how he really just wished that Strom Thurmond could be president. He said, oh, I miss those glorious days of the Segregation Now, Segregation Forever movement. Those were the good times. So he gives this little speech, and all of the major American media was there. They had the video, and they all said, isn't that interesting? How fascinating. Let's go on to the next story. What brought Trent Lott down, the reason he is not in the leadership position of the United States Senate today, was that bloggers, these little kids sitting at the internet, right? They kept writing about it, saying, you know, hell, did this guy just embrace segregation? How can you let him run the Senate? And they kept running it around the internet, and it was kids, college kids, and folks in towns like Chicago just doing their own thing on the internet that brought Trent Lott down. It wasn't our media that brought him down. It was grassroots independent media that brought him down. The bottom line is, independent media knows how to do it. Big media doesn't. Bigness doesn't make you better. And the final lie, the worst lie of all, the biggest lie of all, that we can't change it. I tell you, you know, media is the way it is. It's so big, you can't possibly change it. Well, that's the biggest lie of all. Because you know what? We are about this close to bringing down the whole house of cards. You know who Jon Stewart is? He does a thing called The Daily Show. Jon Stewart's a good guy. I've known him for a number of years. He goes on CNN the other day. Right? He's sitting there with Tucker Carlson. The whitest man ever born. Now, Tucker Carlson's out there with his bow tie, right? And Jon Stewart, I gotta say, Jon Stewart did get off the best line. Carlson's like yelling at him about something, and he says, how old are you? And Carlson says, oh, I'm 35. He says, you're 35 and you wear a bow tie and you're yelling at me? But, the important thing that Jon Stewart did was he got on that show and he said, you guys are hurting America. When you sit on here and you just do spin and you just do the standard political blah, 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 and you don't get anywhere near searching for the truth, you're hurting America. When you put on one boring Democrat, one boring Republican, and they don't say anything, they just yell at each other, you're hurting America. Stop. And you want to know what happened? They put that up on the internet. So far, more than 3 million people have downloaded it. People in this country are desperate for somebody to say what Jon Stewart did, which is, and just what this little boy would do, which is, the emperor's wearing no clothes. We got a media that doesn't do its job. It's hurting America. Jon Stewart went and did it. Everybody got excited. That's how close we are. That's how close we are in this country. We get a few more people out there yelling and screaming, and we're going to start finding that it isn't just a room of folks on a Sunday night here, and I'm so proud that there's so many of you out. There are millions of us all over this country. 3 million people objected when the FCC tried to rewrite the rules to allow big media to get bigger. The largest number of calls to Congress last year to complain after the war was about big media. The fact of the matter is, we're not on the outside anymore begging. We are knocking on that door, and we're going to knock it down. And we are going to force fundamental changes in our media in this country. We're never going to censor anybody, but we are going to break up the big conglomerates. We are going to force standards back in. We are going to make sure that there is funding available and airwaves available for independent media. We are going to make sure that in this country, No longer do we just have big media that lies to us. We will have our media, not theirs. We will have a media that nurtures democracy, that does not fail it. We will have the media that we, as citizens of a democracy, deserve. It is the change that will begin here tonight. You are the change. Be a part of it. Thank you so much for coming out and joining us.
That I want you to take note of. Scott Sanders, a member of the Chicago Media Action Board, who's adjusting lights right now, at 5 o'clock on October 31st, will have Sucha Lee on, as Cliff would call it, the live line. He will be calling in from Massachusetts, where he's a professor, and he is the producer of the film that you've just seen. CAN TV will be airing the film, and then following the film, there'll be a call-in. So tell your friends there's another opportunity to see this film. It needs to be seen. And also, by the way, October 31st at 5 o'clock, we're going to have a comment session. Please understand, we want you all to say what you're thinking about this issue, and we will be aired on CAN TV at least once before the election, what's happening here tonight. So we have minds that we have to impress and change about how they take part in this society, okay? Our next speaker is Salim Muwakkil.
Good evening, folks. Good crowd as ever. Chicago Media Action really draws the folks. I think, it draws the folks. That's always good. And we were very lucky also to have John Nichols speak to us. I've known John for... He is one of the foremost theorists on how to free ourselves from this oppressive corporate media that we're under. And also, he's a columnist for The Nation, and he monitors progressive groups nationwide. People respect him enough to look to him for any kind of information on the progressive things that are happening, the optimistic things that are happening in the country. So we were really lucky to have someone like John speak to us today. Thank you, John. I'm just going to say a few words because I want really to... have a chance to hear what you have to say. That's one of the most important things we have to do here tonight, get the citizens aroused. I'm going to bring up an issue that no one seems to be willing to broach. I'm afraid I'm going to have to appear to be the bad guy in this, and that is the issue of Israel. Although this film, Hijacking Catastrophe, goes further than most in revealing the neoconservative operatives who are behind the Iraq debacle, and how our overall designs in the Middle East mirrors those of Israel, but it too, this film, stops short on placing the blame where we should be placing much of the blame. Not all of it, but much of it. And that's understandable, sort of. Had Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, for example, gone beyond the sorties and revealed Israel's role, it's very doubtful his movie would have garnered the awards and garlands that it did. And I'm not hating on Michael. He's doing excellent work, and he's one of the few who's doing that kind of work. But I'm just pointing out how absent discussion of Israel has been and how odd that is, especially since it is so crucial. But we live in somewhat of a surreal political universe in which we are not supposed to notice certain things or certain people. We're supposed to ignore people like, for example, Douglas Faith, who is a high-ranking official in the Pentagon In fact, he's the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, but he is also a radical Zionist who has composed policy papers for Israel's right-wing Likud government. And even after it was revealed that one of Faith's deputies, a guy named Lawrence Franklin, shared classified documents with members of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, and certain Israeli officials, we are supposed to act as if we don't even notice Israel's connection to all of this. And we act as if we don't notice because if you broach the subject, as I'm doing tonight, you attract charges of anti-Semitism. If you promote any analysis that suggests Jews have power to affect national policy or Israeli officials or Israeli interests have power to affect national policy, you are accused of throwing around old canards. Now, there are canards at large that blame Jews for all things odious. And when I say Jews, I don't mean Jews as a religious group. I'm just talking about the interest of Israel in this particular case, which is the Likud party. And incidentally, there's more dissent in Israel than there is in this country about what the Likud party is doing. So I'm not trying to make any kind of blanket accusation. I just want to make this point that we shouldn't be prevented from any kind of critical thinking about how concern for the security of Israel has warped U.S. policy. We can't let those accusations prevent us from doing that. And this is not, and the media has been, it's been especially absent on this issue. And this is not just a statement. This is not just a statement of conspiracies, conspiratorial paranoia or anything, but it's a matter of record. As this film pointed out, the aforementioned Faith, who I mentioned, he co-authored with a guy named David Wersma, who is currently Vice President Cheney's man for the Middle East, and Richard Pearl, who is the notorious and omnipresent neocon operator, who is often referred to as the Prince of Darkness, for very good reasons. They composed a 1996 strategy paper for Israel's right wing, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, entitled Clean Break, a New Strategy for Securing the Realm. This paper echoed policy prescriptions that had been outlined, and that's the very same paper that this film talked about, that the Wolfowitz Doctrine, that he surfaced during the first Bush regime, but was quietly and quickly squashed because it was too revealing of these insidious motives. It was considered too swashbuckling, I guess you can say, or too testosterone-filled before testosterone became our leading chemical. Now, this paper echoed those prescriptions, and that paper was titled Defense Policy Guidance. But that paper was written by Paul Wolfowitz and Louis Libby, who is Dick's current chief of staff. The similarities are striking, and many of the ideas and notions thrown around in those two neocon-constructed documents were used by the current Bush in his West Point speech, pointing out this new defense strategy. He laid out the doctrine of preemptive war and hinted at, this is what he hinted at previously in his Axis of Evil speech. But aside from the policy similarities, there are also methodological parallels. The Bush administration is purposely, I think, provoking Islamic militancy in order to justify its overwhelming militarism. Now, this is exactly the same tactic that was utilized by Ariel Sharon when he was defense minister, who provoked the Al-Aqsa Intifada with his intrusion into the Al-Aqsa Mosque in September of 2000 with 1,000 police. It was an overt act of provocation. And with that action, Sharon transformed the Palestinian liberation struggle from a secular one to a religious one. And this was his purpose. As a Sharon later rolled this reaction to that to the anger he provoked into the prime ministership of Israel. So it worked for him. And that, as a political figure, he was opposed to the notion of a Palestinian state. And the Palestinians were coming tantalizingly close to convincing the world that this was a legitimate thing, that occupation, as it had been when the Nazis did it, was a bad thing. People don't like to be occupied by foreign powers. And all international law has responded to that particular truism. But he knew, Sharon, that is, he knew that religious passions would transform the Palestinians into enemies worthy of the awesome firepower that the Israeli government has since trained on them. More important, it has allowed him to define the enemy as an irredeemable foe. Similarly, the Bush administration is deliberately stirring up religious passions and cynically exploiting them to further its cause. It's trying to generate a fearsome enemy because fear is the right wing's best ally. But it's an invidious and devious effort, and it yields incredible divisions and short-time gains for these neoconservatives. But we can delay and pervert and divert this dynamic if we act seriously for regime change at home. And while it does help the neocons make their point here and generate the kind of fear that helps them appear to be swashbuckling heroes, it has having a devastating effect on our image worldwide, as most of us know. We are regarded as imperialist bullies throughout the world for good reason, and we're going to have a hard time extracting ourselves from this international swamp unless we start November 2nd. Thank you.
Thank you, Celine. Excellent, excellent analysis of the situation and expressing information or giving you information that you won't hear in mainstream media. And as he said, there are reasons for that. I think in my haste to announce our hijacking call-in with CAN TV, a couple of things. I forgot to thank CAN TV. They are giving people who don't have a voice through the mainstream media a voice, and a much needed one. So I know you've been going through a lot this year in terms of your financing, and please understand, we totally support you as an organization and as a city, and we will do whatever we can to make sure that you survive. And also, I forgot to say to John Nichols, outstanding message. John came down from Madison, and he has a daughter who is at home sick. And he came down because he really wanted to be a part of this town hall forum. And I just want you to know that it was a major sacrifice for him to come today. So I even more so appreciate it. Now we'll hear from the moderator for the rest of the evening. A lot of you who are members of Chicago Media Action and who follow our website and follow our events, you know that Salim Muwakkil is a very good friend of our organization, and we can say the same about this person. He supported us, he has given us airtime, he has given us support in so many ways, and we appreciate it. The most outstanding radio commentator, and we're hoping, by the way, we're trying to get WTTW, your public television station, to have a political talk show that is hosted by people like Salim Muwakkil and Cliff Kelly. There is no table anywhere in Chicago network television where people of color control the agenda. Now understand, yes, we have accomplished, we've made some accomplishments in cable, but cable is something you pay for. We don't own cable. The public owns the network free airwaves, and we demand that they give us the information that we need. So we're still advocating for a political talk show host, a political talk show with WTTW. I'm pleased to announce that for the rest of the evening, you will be guided by Cliff Kelly.
Good evening, everyone. And please give another round of applause to that wonderful lady, Karen Bond. Karen, thank you. As was mentioned by our two excellent speakers, we're going to get to your statements. Just let me say this, though. I want to also say how much we appreciate CAN TV. And I've had Barbara Popovich on a number of times, who is the executive director, and also we've had Alderman Stone on, and I want to commend him because he certainly has insisted that the city council, that the city of Chicago, that is, actually support CAN TV. All it does is, it would only take one trucking contract to take care of the, That's ridiculous. John Nichols is excellent. He was my guest this morning. He was fantastic. Thank you, John. And in fact, I'm going to ask you to be on my other show during this week, so I'll be calling you. Salim, of course, all of you here on my show. And Salim, I think you're going to be on tomorrow, aren't you? Yes, he's going to be on tomorrow, so make sure you listen. Salim has so much to say. They're both just great, and we're going to get to them in just a minute, and also Ronald. Let me say this, that I want to commend CMA. You folks do a great job. You really do. And I'm so pleased to help in any way I can. But it was something that was funny that John mentioned there's a phone up here, and he said you can make the call to the big guy. And then I heard Salim saying some things, and it made me remember that old joke. Of course, I've changed it now. Initially, it was other personnel, but you change things to meet the existing circumstance. So we'll change it to Powell. Secretary Powell, Secretary of State, was traveling, and he was in the Soviet in Moscow with Prime Minister Putin, and he saw Putin had two phones on his desk, a red phone and a white phone. And he said, well, what's the red phone? He said, oh, that's my direct line. That's the hotline to the U.S., to Washington. Oh, okay, that's fine. What's the white phone for? Oh, that's my direct line to God. I said, God? Yes. Well, can I use it? He said, yeah, but it'll cost you the equivalent of $100. And so, you know, Paul pulled out the money and gave it to him, made the call, and so a few days later, he's in Tel Aviv, and he's with Prime Minister Sharon, and he sees the same thing, a red phone and a white phone, and he asked the same question, got the same response. The red phone is his hotline. The white phone is his line to God. And again, Secretary said, may I use the white phone? And he says, yes, you may, but it'll cost you $2. He says, $2? Well, I had the same thing with Prime Minister Putin, and it cost me $100. What's the difference? Sharon says, well, here is a local call. Now, the real problem is he believes it. That's the real problem. And I think that Salim knows that that's one thing I don't back off of. I totally concur with his comments relative to the involvement. In fact, the first time I heard the words regime change came from the Oval Office, but not out of the mouth of the shrub. It was Sharon that said it. At that time, Sharon was spending more time in the Oval Office than Bush was. Bush was talking about weapons of mass destruction. The first time I heard the words, and I was following it very closely, the first time I heard the words regime change was from Ariel Sharon. I just am pleased to be here with these two wonderful men who are journalists, and I always tell people, I am not. These folks are trained journalists, I am not. I am a commentator, and a lady told me the other day, she says, you know, you seem to have an opinion about everything. I says, I do. In fact, I have an opinion about you. Would you? So, those who listen to my show know that. We've been unable to get Keys on. He won't. But although we were able to question him right here in this venue, thanks to the Community Renewal Society, he didn't answer the question, but we were able to ask him. You know, the other thing, too, in talking with hearing John, a lot of people, John, are so surprised when we're talking about the election now. And they said, why would Wisconsin be up in the air? Well, I'm thinking about places like where you live in Madison. You mentioned 72. You know who carried Wisconsin in the primary. Who was it?
Well, in the primary in 72, McGovern won. But you're thinking about George Wallace.
That's who I'm thinking about.
64.
That's what I'm saying. 64. I'm sorry. George Wallace, which shocked a lot of people. Yeah, shocked a whole lot of people, which surprised me, too. You know, I guess some of those folks up in the woods somewhere. So, yeah, right. That's the other interesting thing you mentioned, and I was so pleased to hear you talking about the African-American voter. I'm going to ask you to say that on my show, on the other show on VON. But he's so right on that, and in many instances, African-Americans certainly vote differently than, obviously, many Caucasians, but even progressive or liberal, if you will, and I don't back off of that at all. I think liberal is a great thing. The people who were against slavery were called liberals. But just tonight was a good example. When I came in here, one of the people who works with the organization, who I have a lot of respect for, came up and told me that we are on different sides relative to the presidential election. And he said, I just can't vote for either one of them. Well, one of them that he's speaking of is going to be the president. And as I've told people, and I repeatedly say this, notwithstanding what happens on the second, John Kerry will be a millionaire and the third married to a billionaire. But I and many people like me will be screwed if he is not sitting in the White House. And a lot of folks, as I told the gentleman, and I do respect him as he respects me, we do have a difference. I am more concerned about Supreme Court justices than I think many of our white counterparts have to be concerned about. There are many other things that we have to be concerned about. So, some of my friends, and I think, you know, to some degree, I think that's the reason that Karen and John got into that conversation when she mentioned some of her white liberal friends, just have a different viewpoint as African Americans do, and that's okay. But that's my major concern. One of my major concerns is, of course, the Supreme Court, in addition to many others. You know, the other thing John mentioned that reminded me of something about our press, John was talking about the Irish reporter. I have a friend who I haven't talked to in some time. She's a reporter for one of the top newspapers in France. She lives in Paris. She covered the entire trial of Manuel Noriega and said she will never again have any respect for the U.S. press because of all the people who came in there under oath with no reason to lie, talked about the involvement of the CIA, which we affectionately call Cocaine Import Agency, and all of the drugs and people coming in and saying, and even implicating Bush himself, who was, of course, the head of the CIA at one time, and Noriega worked for him. And I guess Noriega probably kept too much money, and that's why Bush took him out. But she said all of these things that were under oath, that they weren't reported anywhere. If you weren't there in that courtroom, you would not know about it. And she said as a result of that, she didn't particularly care for the U.S. press, but she said after that, never again would she believe anything that the, and not what's reported, as importantly, John, as what's not reported, just as what you were pointing out. Salim was mentioning Israel. There are some things that surprise me, for instance, of the ignorance of some of our public officials, which scares me also. I had to explain to a congressman, Salim, that the same people who own the Sun-Times also own the Jerusalem Post, which is why, in many instances, you see editorials in the Sun-Times that must be written by Sharon. They certainly sound like it. But unless you know from whence this crap comes, then for somebody to believe this garbage, and for me to have to tell a congressman that, and for him to say, gee, I didn't know that, that's pretty pathetic. But again, we have this problem. You certainly were right when you mentioned Sharon created the Second Intifada. And the interesting thing about that is that even the Israeli High Court said he could never again hold the portfolio of defense minister because of his involvement in the massacre of Palestinians in the Sabra and Shatila camps. He was involved in that to the point where they said never again can he ever hold that position, and they thought his career was going downhill. Never did anybody anticipate the fact that he would eventually end up being the prime minister, which is a terrible thing. But I agree that that certainly has, Saddam Hussein was no threat to us, that's for sure, none whatsoever. And in fact, you know, I'd love to represent him and to call those witnesses. I truly believe that they had no intention of capturing him alive. In fact, I have been told, and you may have information with all the people you know, John, that it was not the Americans that captured him, it was the Kurds. That you've heard, otherwise he would be dead, just as they killed his sons and shot his nephew, who, it was totally ridiculous. That was a murder. But this man starts talking. Of course, if he was over in the Cook County Jail, we know that, you know, he'd hang himself. But we don't know what's going to happen. But they had no intention of him. For instance, the film showing Rumsfeld meeting with him and so forth, we support. When I hear that crap about weapons of mass destruction and that he gassed his own people, we supported him in gassing the Kurds because they were supporting the Ayatollah. We supported that. And it's just sickening that our Ambassador Peck, former ambassador to Iraq, said on my show, and I'll never forget it, the last thing he said was, the only reason we have the foreign policy in this country we have is because the American people are unknowing and uncaring. And speaking of uncaring, the prime minister of the Palestinian Authority just said the other day that they're being wiped out in Gaza and nobody even talks about it. And they don't, because everybody's concerned about what's going on in Iraq. Let's get on with our wonderful panel. If John and Celine would please come up. And Ronald. Ronald's going to join us. And we're going to start off with a couple of questions, and then we have a microphone over here to your right that you may ask these wonderful gentlemen questions.